Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Award-winning journalist and author Peter Golden joins us on this week's Book Show to discuss his first novel, Comeback Love. Golden has authored six full-length works of nonfiction and is best known for his writings on the Cold War, which is the time period in which Comeback Love focuses on. At its heart, the novel is a love story, but also a reflection of the thoughts and feelings of that decade. Golden is also the author of the brand new book, Oh, Powerful Western Star, American Jews, Russian Jews, and the Final Battle of the Cold War. It is a great pleasure to welcome Peter Golden to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Let us begin with the novel, because you are so known and so accomplished in both journalism and in nonfiction. How long has a novel been percolating in you?
Well, I've been thinking about it, I guess, since college, and I was always very curious about it, and I wanted to do it. The novel sort of emerged actually from the history book, and so it was while writing the history book that I got the idea for the novel.
Knowing that history allows you to extrapolate and go a fictional route.
Yeah, it does. I mean, most of my professional life, I focus pretty much on the post-war period in America. And what was happening is, as I was writing Oh, Powerful Western Star, I had come back from interviewing Mikhail Gorbachev. And I was writing, and I was working on the manuscript, and I was writing the word Soviet Union and USSR so much that I had to make macros for them on my keyboard. As I was doing that, I was thinking, this is absurd. This place no longer exists. I might as well be writing about Atlantis. And so I asked myself, what was the greatest change in America following the war? And I think it's been the role of women and what's happened in that area. And so the history book is sort of a very wide-angle view of those years, and Comeback Love is a very narrow view of those years, sort of an on-the-ground view. So you extrapolate from the history, because when you write history, you're writing about grand themes and grand people, but that's really not how history plays out. It plays out day to day and in candy stores, walking down the street, the little decisions that people make. So I guess that's why I chose to do it in a novel as well.
And it becomes very personal, obviously, and certainly for these characters. Was there a story that you heard? Was there a fragment of something that struck you, that stuck in you, that you wanted to explore in the novel?
Well, some of my early years as a writer, trying to become a writer, or certainly in the book, and that was very personal. I needed, though, to touch on a couple of basic issues with women. I think, in large part, my sister, who's an attorney, and she's older than I am, and her experiences in law school and then working as a young lawyer had some influence, I think, on my vision, just hearing those stories. But in the long run, I needed a medical student, it seems to me, because of the issues that I wanted to get into, abortion being one of them. So that's how that emerged.
Why was that an important issue for you to discuss?
Because much of what happened in the 1960s between men and women occurred, I guess you could say, because of science. The fact of the matter is, there is a brief time in our history when women both had complete control over their choice of having a child and freedom from lethal venereal diseases. And we think about it now, of course, in terms of AIDS, but even that now they're starting to be able to deal with. But we're going back prior to the penicillin and some of the other drugs they used to treat venereal diseases. People died. People suffered horribly from these things, and it was a constant concern. So society was organized a lot about keeping men and women sort of apart and away from these kinds of things. With the coming of the 1960s, birth control pills, and then abortion, and of course, medical science. This was a very unique moment in history. So I think if that answers your question.
It certainly does. In looking at this character of Gwenna, who is in medical school, but obviously at this point, a very rare thing for a woman to be in medical school.
About 7% of the women at that time, about 7% of medical students at that time were women. Now, I think the number's up at least to 50%. So yeah, it's been a radical change.
And what do you think the reason is for that change? I mean, is it? It's more than just the women's movement in general.
I think it's really the post-war world. Don't forget, I think up until World War II, about half the people in this country lived on farms. I mean, we're a much different culture, and the division of labor now is far different than it used to be. You had based on physical characteristics, men were bigger, and so they did more of the hard labor on the farms. Women bore children, and they were smaller, so they did just as much labor as the men, but they did different things. They carried water. Men were out maybe chopping wood. So I think farm life was pretty rough, so I don't think it really mattered. I mean, this idea of who was doing what was less of an issue. Everybody was working hard, and everybody was tired. Women are simply able to compete in the same ways and do a just as good or a better job than men at something. So I think that's why it happens, a post-industrial society.
What's interesting in the book is while you're exploring this issue of this woman and moving forward and advancing the cause, there are certainly societal and cultural challenges, but there really isn't a bad guy. You know, I mean, you seem to treat all sides fairly in that.
Well, that's a really interesting observation. And actually, while I was writing the book, I had a note on my desk. And the note said, if you can't be fair to both sides, you can't write this story.
Huh.
And it's interesting that you came up with that, you saw that. I felt very strongly that there couldn't be a bad person here. This had to be a result of what was going on in the culture. The fact of the matter is that during the 1960s, the rules changed for women. Women had this world open up to them. Men were sort of just going along on the same track they'd been on all along. And so I was very curious as to the impact that would have on sort of bystanders as women were trying to make these changes in their lives, which were not easy. And we still, the Mommy Wars is clearly a byproduct of what went on in this era. I mean, this is how we're still evolving, because how a culture decides to raise its children to replace the people that die is a primary concern of culture.
So when you talk about being fair to both sides, you're talking about men and women.
Yeah, in this love story, I'm talking about the idea that one was cruel while the other was innocent. Is they're both cruel at times, they're both innocent at times. I think that's how life usually works out. I think, unfortunately, it's very satisfying in the movies to go see a bad guy and a good guy, but I don't know that life is always like that.
No, it's far less black and white. Yeah. When you write a novel like this and it allows you to explore much of the history that you have been researching for so much of your career, is that a challenge at all of not to drown us in facts, to let the story tell the story?
Well, how you do that, you have to be careful about that kind of thing. One of the ways that I did it was by remembering much of my childhood and my teenage years. During that time, what was going on in the culture was expressed in a couple of ways. One was music, which was ubiquitous. Inexpensive transistor radios that came over. So you always heard music everywhere. And the news was on every evening, and there were newspapers. So that was how everything was filtered. And so if you kept when writing the book, if you kept the scenes linked to those kinds of things and didn't intrude on that, that would be, I think, a fair accounting of that time period. But don't forget, young men were constantly worried about the draft. So people paid attention to the news in a way some maybe young men today don't, because they don't have to worry about it. Although you can imagine someone with a son or a daughter in the Middle East right now, or in Afghanistan, parts of that area, pays a lot more attention to the news than Americans who do not have children there.
The book certainly gives you the sense of that time and place, and that sense of what the country was going through, the sights and sounds of that period, but also very much of what was going on in the city of New York.
Well, I grew up outside of New York, and I spent a lot of time there as a teenager, and had a lot of friends there as when I was a teenager in early 20s. And I knew the area around Columbia quite well, the Upper West Side. And so since a lot had happened there, it was pretty easy for me to recapture that time period. And I knew Greenwich Village pretty well on the Lower East Side. So
there's something just romantic about that, though, isn't there?
It was a very interesting place in those days. I mean, I was down recently, and I was actually at Washington Square Park. And it's very different than it used to be. What made it so romantic was New York City, this is hard to believe, used to attract young people because there were affordable places for them to live.
Yeah.
That alone makes it romantic. And I was walking around Washington Square and looking at all the renovations that had been done all along the park. It was a much different place when I was there. And there was a kind of almost noir sort of danger to it. But also, everybody was young, it seemed, everywhere you looked. And we were a big part of the population in those days, and these areas just attracted them in droves. And so, yeah, it was like it was a party, it was a learning experience. But you know, it had a darker part too. There's a scene in the book near Tompkins Square Park, which was really the junkie capital of the world in those years. It was a terrible, terrible place. Now it's beautiful, and it was scary. It was a very scary place.
I found the book interesting too, because these characters are at a point in their lives where life hasn't really slapped them upside the head quite yet. But you do write beautifully about regret.
Well, I told the story. I mean, this is just my general view about history. History is sort of meaningless if you can't relate it to today. So the story in the novel is told from a perspective of now and 30-odd years and 35 years ago. And I think regret is a middle-aged pastime. And I think that people stayed, that was another aspect of the 1960s, people stayed younger longer. And so people in their early 20s in those days were still considered almost like young and being formed. You go back to the World War II generation, the generation of the men who served in World War II and the women they married, they were often parents by that age and owned houses and had all sorts of bills to pay and were well launched along in their careers. People didn't seem to feel that need. But of course, they weren't children of the Depression. My parents' generation were children during the Depression. I grew up, as did most of the baby boomers, during a period of enormous economic expansion. So there was a chance of being more optimistic as opposed to my parents' generation, I suspect.
Peter Golden is our guest on this week's book show. He is the author of the novel Come Back Love, which is published by Washington Square Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. Peter Golden is also the author of the brand new nonfiction book, O Powerful Western Star, American Jews, Russian Jews, and the Final Battle of the Cold War. As you mentioned at the beginning of your conversation, this novel really came out of your investigation into the writing of the history of the nonfiction book. What led you to that subject of wanting to look at this final battle of the Cold War?
Well, originally it was proposed to me to write a book about the Soviet Jewry movement. And I started to look into doing that. I then was doing an interview with a fellow named Max Fisher, who had been involved in private diplomacy between the United States and Israel for many, many years. I wrote his biography. And during that interview, he told me a story about Tiananmen Square, that he had been watching television, and that one of the things that's dropped out in the stories about Tiananmen Square is that Gorbachev visited Beijing around that time, and he landed there. And part of what the students are talking about is, why don't we have as much freedom as they have in the Soviet Union, which was kind of a funny thing, but that was what they were arguing at the time. And what it became clear to me was that this was all part of the Cold War. I mean, people had said that before. This wasn't some great understanding, but it made the idea of just writing a book about, focused on the Soviet Jewry movement, less appealing, and I wanted a wider view. And so I started to tie in the civil rights movement, the cultural changes that had gone on in the United States, all of this led to the Soviet Jewry movement. So if you think, I think of history or historical moments as upside down triangles. They have lots of wide things at the top and they narrow down to the history that you're looking at. And that's how this book proceeds. It opens actually with a wonderful story I found in the National Archives about a Russian Jewish grain dealer in May of 1865 who was distraught over the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And he writes to the American consulate about these issues. And it's an amazing story. And in this letter, it matches the Whitman observation, the elegy that Whitman wrote for Lincoln when he talked about, powerful fallen Western star. And what Whitman meant was that sort of Lincoln would go away and all of these things would go away with him. And since I see the Cold War as basically a moral argument, I don't believe it went away. And so there's this notion of freedom, of democracy, this powerful, this Western star. And so I go all the way back into the 18th century and the whole idea of city on a hill. So I really look at it from an American point of view and how this impacted Russians. Now, not just Russian Jews. Americans had been very popular in Russia for some time. Benjamin Franklin's books were bestsellers. The Constitution was passed around, was copied and translated and passed around, as was the Declaration of Independence. So the book deals a lot with American history and the cultural changes that I write about in Come Back Love.
And obviously, you're talking about this period of the Cold War, but also very much founded, that the baseline here really comes out of World War II, the Holocaust, that generation.
Absolutely. The Holocaust is directly responsible for, I believe, for the creation of the State of Israel, which changes all the geometry of the Cold War. Some people, of course, know this, but one of the things I found fascinating is that it was ultimately the Soviet Union that armed the Israelis and made it possible for them to hold on during 1948. The United States refused to arm them or even lend them money. It was Stalin that made the decision to arm them and through Czechoslovakia. And of course, the reason was, in part, at least the Golda Meir's, the prime minister, former prime minister of Israel's view, was that Russia had suffered so terribly during the Second World War that they felt a kind of a kinship for a while with the Israelis. And also, whatever we did, the Russians did the opposite. I mean, the Cold War, very serious business, but as you start doing it as a historian and you make your timelines and you look at facts, it's like whatever we decided to do, the Russians did the opposite. I mean, they made it out to be sort of philosophical. But I'm sure had we backed the North Vietnamese, the Russians would have backed the South Vietnamese. And that's how the Cold War went on.
In the people that you talked to, you mentioned earlier sitting down and having a conversation with Mikhail Gorbachev, who I assume that at the time of the interview was how long ago? That was
about 6 years ago.
So there is time for context. There is time for reflection. And how did that differ from some of the other personal interviews that you used for the book with Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon on that period?
Well, it was interesting. You know, by then he had clearly seen how unpopular he was at home. At the same time, as the wonderful Cold War historian John Lewis Gaddis has observed, he's probably the one winner of the Nobel Peace Prize who absolutely deserves the Nobel Peace Prize because he had an option to do things far differently. And I think he had come to see that. I think he had come to believe that his accomplishments were going to be carried forward in history because he had saved the world from a sort of a cataclysm. But he was still very angry at Ronald Reagan. And so when he started to talk about it, he became very worked up about it. So I think in the moment, while he was speaking, that part he hadn't reflected much on. The other part was how he was thought of by Jews, which is very interesting because by then he had visited Israel a number of times. And I asked him about that, and he said that he had no idea how he would be remembered, but he knew that they would never forget him, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at it, because he said they were a people who don't forget, which is an interesting way of describing them.
It is. It's also interesting that we, I'm 45 years old, but I still live through that that period and look back on it. But now we're coming into these generations that I can't even say take it for granted, much less, you know that it existed.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And more to the point, currently, is the problem between Iran and Israel. And this is where the ignorance of the Cold War, I think, is really complicating matters. The Cuban Missile Crisis is now, in my view, being repeated between Iran and Israel, although Iran is now in the position of being both the Soviet Union and Cuba. And the way that people casually discuss these exchanges that might occur between these two countries is so bizarre. No one who grew up knowing about what had happened with just the firebombings in Japan, let alone what happened when the atom bomb was dropped, would have discussions about nuclear exchanges in any casual way. Eisenhower, or knows about Eisenhower and mutually assured destruction, he wasn't kidding around that literally tens of millions of people would have died in these exchanges. And people seem to have lost that. That was a big part of the Cold War. In the book, I describe it as a record of the fear of nuclear exchanges. The Cold War, much of the Cold War history is that.
And much of the conversation that we have when it comes to foreign policy in this country, especially during this an election year, still revolves around that time and what happened and what we set up to do. And yet, in some cases, it seems like we learn from our mistakes, and in others, you wonder whether we need a tap on the shoulder.
Well, yes, you do wonder. One of the things I've been thinking about recently is that the Cold War was basically, as I said earlier, a moral argument. I don't think we're really the moral leaders of the world anymore. I think that era is over. I think the illusion that we don't operate out of self-interest, I don't think the world is fooled by that anymore. I think there are many things to envy about this country, about our values. But the idea that we do what we do out of some grand moral component, I think is gone. I think that it was important in the Cold War. It was one of the things that made Martin Luther King so powerful and gave him so much sway with the White House, was that first Kennedy and then Johnson were both terribly concerned about how we appeared to the rest of the world. A very interesting story is that Eisenhower, during Little Rock, went on TV and said that the people who weren't letting these children into school were giving comfort to our enemy and they were traitors. That was how, because the idea that we would limit anyone's freedom while we were talking about the lack of freedom in the Soviet Union. Mm. So I don't think the world buys that anymore. I don't think the world believes it. Certainly not in the Middle East.
When you look at future novel writing, will you do this in concert with more history that you're writing?
Well, that's very interesting. I've already sold my next novel to Atria, which is the division of imprint of Simon & Schuster. And it's again going to be rooted in history. This history will be from 1938 to about 1966. That's really my area. So I take in both the Holocaust, which I've written a great deal about in A Powerful Western Star, and all the way up until the mid-1960s. Whether a history will emerge from that, I haven't thought about the next history I'd like to write. I think I'd like to write a biography, but I haven't figured out who I want to write it about yet.
The name of the novel is Comeback Love. It is published by Washington Square Press, a division of Simon & Schuster. The nonfiction book is O Powerful Western Star, American Jews, Russian Jews, and the Final Battle of the Cold War, which is published by Geffen. Peter Golden is our guest on the book show this week. A great pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck with all the volumes.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the books are O Powerful Western Star, published by Geffen, and Comeback Love, published by Washington Square Press. Thank you so much for being with us. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.